The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Commentary Track. Glad to see you again, metaphorically speaking. I'm your host, Frank Thompson. My arm is long and my vengeance total. Today we have a very special guest, a friend of mine, somebody I've known for a long time. I have a feeling you're getting sick of hearing that if you've listened to every episode, because so far, almost everybody I've interviewed is somebody I've known for quite a long time. And that's going to continue for a while, so keep your pants on, it's fine. Soon, I'll start interviewing total strangers, and then you'll hear me introduce them by saying, I have no idea who this is, so let's talk with them and see, shall we? And then you'll be sorry. But in this case, it's someone that I've known for a long time, a very good friend of mine, one of the most accomplished movie professionals that I know. His name is Joseph Musso. I call him Joe. Everybody does. I think if you look him up on IMDb, it's Joseph. But Joe Musso is a production illustrator, storyboard artist, conceptual artist. He has worked, as you'll hear in this episode, with Alfred Hitchcock on virtually every movie of Irwin Allen's. He's worked on most, if not all, of the Clint Eastwood films of, I'd guess, the last 20 years. Just finished work on a Judd Apatow film. He never stops working. He was even on several episodes of Monk. Joe is a busy guy, an incredibly gifted guy. He's also a major historian, not a film historian. That's for unaccomplished guys like me. No, Joe's the real thing. He's an expert on many, many, many historical subjects, but he and I met because of our mutual interest in the Alamo. And you'll probably be hearing that a lot as we continue on these podcasts. Because I've met a lot of people through the Alamo. I don't know how to explain this. Someday we'll do an Alamo podcast and we'll try to talk about it. But Joe is an authority on the subject of the Alamo, more specifically an authority on the subject of Jim Bowie. And Joe's personal collection is something you have to see to believe. And I often leave his house with a headache from having just experienced too much. His house is not only kind of a museum, it's literally a museum, and he has real historical artifacts as well as movie props and all sorts of incredible things. And he's also a great, great guy and a very generous fella and somebody I like a whole lot. And so he was one of the first people I got in touch with to do a commentary track with, and so we actually did this 3 or 4 months ago, I guess, and I'm just now getting around to it. I've had a little bit of a backlog of these things. One of these days I want to start getting more day and date with them, but I'm really not quite sure what point there is in that. So we will talk with Joe, and here's the thing. I have a good long talk with him. I guess the interview lasts about an hour. And we only scratch the surface of his career. I mean, we talk about Hitchcock. We talk about a few more of his professional accomplishments. But we don't even get into Eastwood or Irwin Allen. So, as I say to him at the end of the interview, we've got to do it again. And in his case, I think we probably have to do it at least 4 more times. To even scratch the surface of what he's seen and done and the people he's met. If you've ever seen any of these Irwin Allen films, you'll see they were star-studded. And so just by working on any one of those, he met more Hollywood stars than I'll ever meet in my lifetime, and he worked on all of them. So Joe has stories to tell, and I hope you'll really enjoy tonight's talk with him. And look forward to some more talks with him in the future. Here's Joe Musso. For all our listeners who never worked with Alfred Hitchcock, let's start with him. Tell me which films you worked on and a little bit about the experience of working with him on a day-to-day basis.
Okay, basically I worked with Alfred Hitchcock on Torn Curtain. It was a project that went on for about 8 months. And because of the fact that the film took place in East Berlin, we could not actually go there to film. He did have some second unit stuff done ahead of time in West Berlin, some drive-bys with a bus. But all the sets, basically existing standing sets, exteriors, interiors, had to be recreated on the Universal Studios. Consequently, at the time, we had a record of having the most expensive, you might say, art department budget, and that included Spartacus, because all the sets had to be recreated. And, of course, Hitchcock, we had to lay out everything for him. And in some respects, not only was I doing conceptual renderings of the actual sets in detail, in perspective, but also I was doing storyboards for him in color. And he was a, you know, pretty hands-on director, producer, because he liked everything that was done under his watchful eye. So consequently, everybody that worked for him, basically in pre-production and also in production on the film, had their offices in his production company. So there was, as you entered the front of his production company, on one side was his massive office. On the other side was his producer's office. That was Peggy Robinson. And there was a long hallway with many, many doors. And along those doors were his assistant directors, his writers. As a matter of fact, on one side he actually had a screening room with a full-time projectionist, which he would just study one film after another. And films that didn't even relate to his projects, but he just wanted to see all the films for reference, how different people did things. And at the end of the hall was divided in half. One half was the editorial department. The other half was the art department. And within the art department room, there were like different cubicles that we worked in. And mine was the first one you entered when you entered the door of the art department. So consequently, when Hitchcock would walk up and down the corridors to see what was happening, he would always, I'd be there painting away and finding him standing over my shoulder and watching me paint. He, being an artist himself, I think he was really fascinated with the process. And and there was times where different people, if there's something that displeased him, he would nod no. And if sometimes he liked what he saw, he would nod yes. And fortunately, I got more yes nods than no nods, so that kind of made me feel good. But it was really quite telling. And also, too, when he started bringing in the main stars, his company was like a family. And which, interesting enough, years later, when I worked for Irwin Allen, basically he treated everybody like a family too. So when the stars came on, in this case being Paul Newman and Julie Andrews and some of the other supporting actors, Hitchcock would bring them on a tour through the office and introduce them to everybody. And so consequently, I was sitting there working away, and I got introduced to Paul Newman and Joey Andrews. And as a matter of fact, I was introduced to Paul Newman twice, first time by Alfred Hitchcock and a second time by Irwin Allen. But and even though he really, to the outside, had a closed set, for those within his company, the set was open and that we could actually go there at times. And he actually invited, because if there was something going on, if there was something that we would see, particularly like with the art department, that something that, you know, may have not been right, or he really would like to have it to his attention. And so, I mean, he was a real pro like that, because all this stuff was prepared months ahead of him getting ready to film. And so
so he was always kind of famous for liking to have the whole film totally mapped out before he started shooting.
Well, in this case, he didn't really have everything mapped out, but he had a good portion of it, and things were getting mapped out as we went along. And at times, he invited a little creativity. For instance, when we were doing the airport, I was doing, he wanted the walls in the interior security offices to be like a gray brick, but painted gray, an austere medium gray. And it was kind of austere, but it was a little, it was kind of flat. So in doing the painting, I differentiated some of the bricks a little darker, a little lighter gray, just to kind of, in my opinion, give the sketch a little more oomph to it than just a flat wall, particularly since he wanted it rather austere. He didn't want the shadows. Well, of course, he saw that, and he thought it was a brilliant idea. Well, production designer Hein Heckroth, who was really one of the top production designers from Europe, looked and said, well, I'm not sure as far as that. We may have to gray it down. But all of a sudden, Hitchcock came in and says, I like it. So it's like, how did you know to do that? And I was just going by my own artistic ability, saying it just gives it a little bit more life to it. Still austere, but it just had a touch more character. And so that's where they went ahead and filmed it. He also wanted to do things different. In other words, like with the airplane, when it landed at this airport in East Berlin, rather than just show an airplane in the foreground and the airport in the background, he said, that's always been done before. What he wanted to do was he'd have the people come out of the airplane, but when they entered the airport facility itself, the whole reflection of the airplane was in the glass. So this way, he tied it together, but tied it together so it wasn't just a standard tie-in shot, which we could have easily done through matte painting, miniatures, or whatever, but actually to recreate in the background, the airplane in the reflection and in the backdrop in the airport as they enter the airport with a scenic backing of the airplane out there. So basically did it in reverse. He just wanted to do things a little different, which is what made Alfred Hitchcock Alfred Hitchcock. But these were things that he thought up himself. And of course, one of the other areas were in the script really didn't allow for, at that time, what were the ruins of old Berlin. And even though the script didn't describe it, Hitchcock liked the idea of showing the ruins. And the question is, where can we show the ruins of old Berlin that were bombed out from World War II? And because he liked the dichotomy. Here we're talking about new spy stuff, and what he wanted was a subtle reminder of what the last bit of mayhem created with Germany. And so we decided in a couple of areas, with discussions with him, all ahead of time, that there was a couple of areas where it really would fit in. And the first one was in the security office of the Russian security chief. And Paul Newman and Julie Anders are ushered into the office. He wanted this austere office. And out the window, which on one side of the wall was all picture windows, floor-to-ceiling glass, he wanted like a wall, but over the wall you would see all the bombed out areas of old Berlin. And here the security chief and Paul Newman are drinking a toast, because Paul Newman is a scientist pretending to defect. So they're drinking a toast to this, and while they're drinking the toast, the audience is treated with the bombed out ruins of old Berlin, which again was created by a backing, but a few things, leaves, whatever, plants, things blowing in the wind to, of course, give the backing some movement and give it a reality. The other one was a big art museum in East Berlin. There was a scene where Paul Newman is trying to evade his you might say, this bodyguard who's assigned to look after him, and he's trying to make contact with somebody in the underground. So the idea was to have the ruins of Old Berlin as Paul Newman exits this art museum and see it in the background against over a wall. You see the ruins where Paul gets in a cab to go away. But the other thing is, how do we do the art museum? Since that's in East Berlin, and obviously the Russian government wasn't really in a mind to let us go over there and film that, and there was no way we could get any, you know, steal any shots from West Berlin, we decided to use what they call as a matte painting. And Universal at the time was fortunate enough to have one of the, I think, one of the finest matte artists around, Al Whitlock, on staff at the time to execute their mats. And of course, Hitchcock loved Al Whitlock because, besides being British like Hitchcock was, he was also a person who could create all Hitchcock's fantasies and dreams and bring them to life. And for those who don't know what a matte painting is, it's basically a painting of an object or a subject that actually fits in or superimposed over a live action background. And in other words, let's just say you see a bunch of knights in shining armor riding up a hill into a castle. Well, they don't want to go to Europe to film the castle, so they just show the knights riding up the hill, build a gate, and then the castle itself is painted on either a sheet of masonite or some sort of board or a sheet of glass. And actually, but kind of registered with the composition of the shot itself, and then combined with it, and there was different ways to combine the painted image with the reality, but when you see it on the screen, the knights are actually riding into the castle, which they're riding into a painting of the castle. Well, in this case, with the art museum, we had, you know, Paul Newman go down the Universal parking lot, and he had areas marked off, which in those areas in a parking lot, which would be considered the sidewalk with which you would go into the museum. And then we built some doors. So really what you really had was a cleared area of the parking lot with Paul running down with a locked off camera, going into a pair of doors. And that was it. Behind him was all of Universal Studios and Universal City and the smog of Los Angeles and all its glory. And with that piece of film, Al Whitlock took and painted the whole art museum and gave a kind of a grayish sky too. So some of the skies, the smoggy skies of Los Angeles during the day, kind of fit in because Hitchcock really didn't want it to look pretty. He wanted it to look gray and austere in East Berlin. And so Paul went in the doors, but really, when you saw it on the screen, he's walking inside the art museum. Well, naturally, when he gets inside the art museum, now he's being pursued by this bodyguard. Now he's got to go through the museum. Now Hitchcock just didn't want him to walk in the museum and walk out the back door. He wanted this, you know, build a little suspense going through the museum. But like I say, we couldn't go there to film the museum. So Hitchcock had his dream up all kinds of shots and angles of Paul going through, and it would be filmed twice, both with Paul going through and with the bodyguard pursuing him, through different parts of the museum where Paul is trying to lose the bodyguard. And of course, this would have meant building, say, an element of wall, maybe with a painting on it, recreated some master, old master on the painting, and Paul Newman go by. But beyond that, the rest of the frame would be filled with Al Whitlock's painting of the rest of the museum, the columns, the museum in all its glory. And there was one high angle we laid out where, as if the camera was up in the rafters looking down the museum, and you see the columns of the museum gone away in perspective, and below Paul Newman is this lone solitary figure going across this glorious marble floor of the museum and all the walls of the paintings, the old masters and this. And of course, and at the same time, he would be And a couple frames later, or a couple of shots later, the bodyguard would be pursuing him. Well, Paul read the script, and he, of course, according to the script, he was supposed to go through the museum. Now, he's already been in the parking lot and was told the doors of the museum. Now he's getting in here, and he's expecting this big shot of this big museum set. And he walks in there, and all the whole soundstage is dark. There's a camera crew up on the rafters, and there's a strip of marble paper gone across the floor. And I mean a strip of marble paper gone across the floor that I believe it was one of the other artists, Mort Rabinowitz, and somebody else helped paint all this marble painter, the repeater pattern. And they just rolled it across the floor, laid it out. And Hitchcock told Paul to run, walk very quickly, briskly through the marble paper. And Paul sort of said, well, Hitch, he says, what's my motivation for going through this marble paper? He, instead of seeing a museum, he saw black walls, the camera crew up, and marble paper. And Hitchcock just looked at him and said, well, if you don't stay on the marble paper, you'll disappear under the mat, and nobody will ever get to see you in this movie. So, and Paul did what he thought, didn't quite get it. Of course, when the film came out, there he was. Paul was, it was the whole museum. The interesting thing is that there was a German actor in the film, Chris Anders, who played the aide to the security chief. And, I think it was Hans-Jörg Felmy was the security chief. Anyhow, it found out after we did the film that he actually lived in the same apartment building that I lived in. So we got to talking, and when the film came out, he got calls. Now, Chris was only in those couple of scenes, but he got calls from friends of his who actually were from Germany, since he was from Germany, and they wanted to know how Hitchcock was able to sneak a camera crew into East Berlin, because we recreated the museum exactly, which is a testament to Hitchcock, to motion pictures, and the art of what we can do and fool the public. And
for people who don't understand the difference, and I'm not quite sure at this moment I quite understand the difference. You do conceptual art for a film. Then there's also storyboard. Conceptual art is just to give basically the whole feeling of what the of what the scene should look like.
Right.
And then a storyboard would be
Shot for shot.
How you accomplish it.
Right. Well, and particularly now, sometimes the conceptual sketches are, in some cases, there's degrees of conceptual sketches. Some are ideas to sell a film that are not necessarily at times translated in a movie. But there's other ways, and at this time, what we did is, what we say conceptual sketches today, in those days, it was really what we would call set sketches. And they were very accurately projected sketches in perspective. I mean, we could do some conceptual scenes of a set, but then we would take and back project it and give some, like a set designer who is like a drafts person, plans and elevations with which they can put the details in on the set. And we had a system where we can actually show, and I still use it today, times of what the film is going to look like if we're using a 40 or 50 millimeter lens, or 30 or 25 whatever millimeter lens, say 40 or 75 feet away from the rear wall of a soundstage or a set, wherever the set may be, at say a 4 foot high or 5 foot camera angle, and show you exactly what will be seen on film, how high up they had to build the sets, whether they had to put a ceiling on a set or a header to kind of fake it so they didn't have to put a ceiling on the set, or if they should have to lower the camera angle. But basically, if it was an accurate rendition of what the set would look like, they could decide what color of the paint they wanted to use on the walls, the type of furniture they wanted in there. All this was sort of basically laid out ahead of time before they, and the director could say, hey, I want something a little more modern, I wanted a little more this, I wanted a little more that, or I want another room off of here. And we would do things at times to make the sets look interesting. Instead of just giving four walls, maybe we would have a hallway or return or another room seen through there just to give the set some depth, some interest. But of course, it was dictated with the script too. If the script said that somebody came out of a room off the, into the living room, off the bedroom, or out of the kitchen, naturally that had to be reflected in the set. Now, once those set sketches were approved, particularly at that time, sometimes they would build actually quarter-scale models, sort of paint them up, and give like a little periscope to the director to have him plan his shots. And he'd work his shots out where he wanted to film, and if it looked like a fourth wall wasn't going to be in a shot, that fourth wall didn't get built. And also to would tell them, we would do things like wild the wall. If the camera had to get back in a certain area, the wall that it had to get back in could be actually removed and taken out of the way so the camera crew could fit in there, but then return when the camera was shooting the opposite direction against that wall. But once that was done, and different directors have different ways of working, we would then do storyboards, or we used to call them continuity sketches. And what it would do is we would actually block out when to cut from a long shot to a close-up. In other words, if the main character is entering a room left to right, going across the screen in that direction, and he meets another person in that room, say a woman, when you cut to a close-up, even though the close-up is not a profile of the actor, but on the actor's face, it might be a slight three-quarter left to right since he entered left to right in the master shot. And then, of course, when the person he's talking to is talking back, it would be just the opposite. It would be right to left. And so that's the simple way of explaining it. Of course, it could get more convoluted because many times a director, if they're bringing an actor into a room, rather than just sit the camera down and show the room so the audience knows what the room looked like, they'll actually move the camera along with the actor as he walks across the room to somebody else. And in doing so, you're sort of panning across the room and you're revealing the room to the audience. The audience hasn't read the script. They don't know what the room is. And so, consequently, and then the question is, what do you put into the room? What's the character? If the character is, say, a lawyer or doctor, maybe when you enter this room, you might see a bookshelf with a lot of books on it. If it's, say, a woman who is trying to eke out a living, you know, you might see some flowers on the wall, very few books on the wall, only because she probably doesn't have time to do the books. And but it'd be, have a much more feminine touch than, say, a massive type of thing of, say, books or, you know, oak or walnut or mahogany, you know, bookshelves on the wall. So it's what is this character? The person, by looking at that room, the audience, you know, hopefully we get to understand that character a little bit. So you want, you know, whatever that character is, of course, if it's somebody who is slovenly or doesn't really or, you know, drinks a little bit, naturally the room is going to be obviously a little bit unkept and maybe the pictures on the wall aren't going to be totally straight. You know, little things like that to reflect the character of the person who's supposed to live there. That's what would happen. And we would lay that out all ahead of time because many times the production company really doesn't want to travel on location for some of the sets like that because of the fact that it means they to an actual house. I mean, the audience thinks they just went to a neighbor in an actual house and filmed it. It doesn't always work that way. They may do some exteriors there, but the interiors, they like on a soundstage, they have the control, the actors can concentrate, they're not bothered by fans, you know, asking them for their autograph or, you know, trying to interfere with the shot. And so they have all the control and they can work quickly and efficiently. And, of course, Hitchcock loved to basically work in a controlled environment, either on the stage or the studio backlight like Universal, which has really got a great backlot. They use it for the tours now. But the New York Street has been rebuilt quite a few times. And after the fire they had a few years ago, it's really, really has been, you know, the ultimate in rebuilding. But some of the other streets, they have European streets, Western towns, things like that, that when they have to film, they can go revamp them, change the signs, and they can take a New York street and with a few touches here or there, make it like a streets in Sweden or maybe Italy or England, by doing some, you know, subtle architectural things to that particular street. But they have the control to do what they want. And the other thing is that sometimes in shooting into infinity, they could actually do some clever things, particularly now with CGI, make that street look like it's gone on forever and not even have to worry about whether they're going into unwanted mat areas or not now. So, you know, today the sky's the limit. But way back when with Hitchcock, it's amazing they got the kind of things that they got on screen because they had to be very clever. The composition had to be worked out in such a way that some of these match shots had to tell the total story. So they had to be thoughtfully laid out. And then they do very clever things. They would do things like have a second unit do a drive-by on some streets in Los Angeles that they can say was New York City or Chicago, and then sort of pan off the streets to a wall, and the wall on the optical printer actually go to a guy and a girl or a couple of cops sitting in the car in an alley somewhere. All they needed is a straight line, and that printer could actually move. And so in the audience's mind, they just saw this big chase going through the streets and with no cutaway go to two people sitting in the car in an alley, thinking that was also done on location, but that part was done on the stage. And Hitchcock really understood that, you know, the things he could do, the limitations he couldn't do, and, you know, he obviously pushed the envelope wherever he could to take things, do things different, make things seen in ways that they haven't normally been seen before, but do it in the context of the story that you're not aware of it until after you see it.
Now, although it seems like most of your work would be done before the filming, you were on the set a lot during the actual production,
yeah,
right? And what were you up to during that time? Was there last-minute things that had to be done or changes that were being made or what?
A little bit of both because basically the pre-production naturally started ahead of time for the scenes in the film that were going to be shot right away. But as the film got underway, there were still other sets that had to be done. Some sets were revamps or reworking of previous sets. So in some areas, we could not do everything ahead of time, so it had to go along. And in this case, I was basically, because Hitchcock was doing things and sometimes coming up ideas, coming up with sometimes with last-minute changes, I was basically there for the entire production of the film. And it was, again, an interesting experience where they wanted to keep everybody, in other words, they wanted the team together as long as they could because in Hitchcock, in John Ford's case, I guess he used to keep all the actors and supporting actors around because he never knew he had an idea. In Hitchcock's case, I think he wanted to keep his visual team together because he never knew when he got another idea to do a little of this, a little of that, and change it and say, Joe, we need some scenes blocked out here and take the actors here. Let's show this. Let's show some shadows here. So he could, and then sometimes he'd stand over me and say, put some shadows, because he wanted to show the cameraman what he wanted. He did not want to wait till he got to the set to figure out if the shadow worked here or the shadow worked there. And since we were working with precise renderings of each of these sets, when we put a shadow in and he said to the DP he wanted a shadow there, he knew that a shadow would work in that area and that the DP could get that shadow. And so in this case, it's almost like we were working right along, and and also at the same time, by going on the set and seeing the set as it's lit, if there was some attention to detail that they hadn't got by keeping us on the set, if we saw something, he invited us to let him know. And, you know, it was just a real hands-on. We were part of a team, and the idea was that this is what he wanted, and we wanted to make it as working as magical for him as it could. And you know, that's what we endeavor to do. So,
now you said that when you were working on Torn Curtain, you would often go to a soundstage next door and see the filming of another movie that you and I have yeah. a certain amount of interest in.
Yeah, as a kid, I always loved the French Foreign Legion, and at the time, ironically, one of Hitchcock's favorite art directors who wasn't on the Torn Curtain because Hitchcock used Hein Heckroff for the European look was Henry Bumstead. And Bummy, as we called him in the industry, was doing the Universal remake of Beaujesse with Guy Stockwell and Doug McClure and Telly Savalas. And they had recreated the French Foreign Legion fort on the set. They were on location out in Yuma at on the sand dunes down there and doing the exteriors. But the interior of the fort was done on the soundstage. And it was right next door to Hitchcock's office, right across the there was like a little street right across the street was the soundstage, and I'm sitting there painting away, thinking of gray bricks and austere East Berlin, and I'm hearing all the machine guns and the Tuaregs and the Arabs and the Legionnaires, all the carrying on that was going on the soundstage. And even though the soundstage was pretty soundproof with some of the machines going off, I could hear a few things that were going on. So, when I took a break or during my lunch hours, I would, go to the stage next door. And of course, while there, I met the production designer Henry Bumstead and formed a lasting friendship with him that, you know, translated years later.
You met him in that way?
In that time, he was called on to do that. And I met him at that time, and then years later, as Henry went on to do work for Sidney Poitier, Clint Eastwood, he took me along with him. And so it was one of those things where you might say I worked with Bummy almost, not quite up to the day he died, but pretty close to it. And
the only time I ever met him was in your presence. when you were working on Space Cowboys.
Space Cowboys, yeah. Right. So,
and you were both in pretty much the same office over there.
Yeah.
Warner's lot.
Yeah.
Now, working with Hitchcock and going to watch this remake of Beaujesse being made and all this stuff, it must have had a special meaning to you because you've always been such a movie buff. You love movies since you were a kid, right?
Yeah, I was at the time I was a little bit beside myself because I couldn't believe a lot of this. Actually, I made it all happen because as a little fella, growing up back in Vineland, New Jersey, when I was five or six. I loved to draw, and I decided at that time I wanted to be a cartoonist for Walt Disney, doing Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck. And along the way, I my mother took me to a couple of the Johnny Weissmuller Tarzan films as a kid, so I kind of liked Tarzan. And in the comic strip, somehow the Tarzan comic strip, they had a kind of a new artist by the name of Bob Lubbers. And I just, as a kid, I just thought his drawing was magical, his use of thick and thin lines. And so I studied it, and I tried to trace him. And I, like a lot of children, have a love to draw. But what I had was not just a love to draw. I wanted to stick with it until I got it right. And the fact that suddenly I was drawing Tarzan, and I was drawing lions and elephants and gorillas. I was actually learning human anatomy. At the same time, I'm still doing all these Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck drawings. And then when I was about 10 years old, I saw King Kong on a reissue. And I looked at that, and in my 10-year-old mind, I put it together that somebody had to lay this out. And I decided at the age of 10 that, no, I didn't quite want to be a cartoonist for Walt Disney anymore. What I wanted to do is work in live-action films and lay out these great scenes that I saw, like in King Kong. And I saved my allowance up. It was during the summer, during the reissue. And I think I went to the movie every day for 2 weeks. That was as long as it was playing in my hometown. And I tried to memorize each scene. And when I came home, I tried to do my own comic book, because those rascals at the movie theater wouldn't give me the stills or the publicity material. So I figured I wanted to retain the scenes in my mind. So I tried to memorize the scenes. And since I was already doing, redoing Tarzan and, with the, you know, gorillas and everything, I figured, well, that's, that was a step to doing King Kong. And, so, you know, from 10 years old, I decided I wanted to work in live action and I wanted to come to Hollywood. And the other love I had at the time was history. I love to read about different historic events. As a kid, and I try to visualize these scenes, and I would see different movies at the time that, you know, stimulated my fancy. You might say, like Fort Apache and the Four Feathers and Gunga Din and Beaujeste and The Adventures of Robin Hood with Errol Flynn. And at the same time, I was trying to recreate these scenes too, but I would go further, and I wanted to read the historic background. And I'm saying, well, here's an event. This hasn't been covered. I want to try to do this or recreate this scene and that. So I decided not only, now this, by this time I'm like 12 and I'm deciding, well, I just don't want to go to Hollywood to work on any kind of movie or like effects movies like King Kong. I wanted to work on historic movies. So, and the idea that I would come and work for Cecil B. DeMille, and well, I went through, college. At first I thought I could just pack my bags, come to Hollywood. But my father said, no, we saved the money. You're going to go to school. You like to draw. How about we'll check out an art college? And I figured, yeah, well, maybe I better get some, formal training behind me. So I ended up going to the Philadelphia Museum College of Art, which is now referred to as the University of Arts in Philadelphia, and I got a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree. And at that time, they were drafting at 23, and I figured, well, I don't want to go to Hollywood, start work, and then get drafted, so I went and got my military service out of the way. But then I figured that it was about time. And I decided that I was, from the money I saved up in the service, that I was going to go. I figured I needed some experience in New York City doing some men's magazines before I go to Hollywood, because that was going to be a lot more competitive. And I couldn't get anything in New York City. So I figured, well, if I got to go to Hollywood and wash dishes and wait for the break, at least I'm going to be where it's at. So, so I ended up packing my bags. And I went to, I had, what can I say, a camera case full of shoes around my back, clothing bag in my portfolio, and $200 in my pocket that I had saved up. And I went to California, and I did it the most naive way. I got a one-bedroom apartment in Hollywood for $90 for the first month. No idea how I was going to pay for the second month. And had a phone put in, and I started making phone calls. And I called all the studios, and I would just ask who the head of the art department was. And when they told me, could I please speak to him? And, of course, there was, you know, about seven major studios in town. And within a short period of time, I found out who the heads of the art department were and who their assistants were. So I would call them from time to time. And they will, you know, have you worked in the industry before? No. And I tried it. Well, I was a New York illustrator. I did this and that, which I really didn't. But I had illustrations in my portfolio that were comparable to, say, magazine art, and showed architecture, how well I could do people in my portfolio. So it was kind of going on for a few weeks. And finally, I talked to the assistant head of the art department at 20th Century Fox, Lynn Sparhawk. And he said, no, we just hired somebody last week. And I said, well, you think you could just take a look at my portfolio to think, see if I got what it takes to be in the industry? And I started to say I did this and that in New York. And I don't know what it was, but he decided, he said, well, he says, maybe I should take a look at it. He said, you doing anything tomorrow? And I said, no. So he set it up. I went over the next day. I think it was about 10:30. And he looked at the portfolio, didn't say anything. And I don't know if it was my portfolio or me, but he looked at it and he says, you know, he says, this is one of the best portfolios I've seen all year. He said, like I told you, we just hired somebody last week. He said, well, let me see what I can do for you. And he said, I'm not going to promise anything, but let me see. And he said, by the way, are you doing anything? You got any other plans? And I said, no. He said, well, come on, I'll show you around the art department. So he was showing what we did, who this and that and everything. And I'm saying, well, geez, I'm sold. And he said, again, like I say, I can't promise anything, but let me see what I can do. The next morning, it was about 10, the phone rang. A woman's voice on the phone, and I'm looking at myself like, who can be calling me? Because the only time people are calling me now is either sell me magazines since I got on the phone. And I answer a woman's voice, and she said, Joe, I understand, or Mr. Musa, and I said, yes. She said, I understand you wish to work in the motion picture industry. And I said, well, yes. And she said, well, this is the motion picture union. Could you come over right away? And I said, something really brilliant, like, can I brush my teeth first? And she said, oh, yes, and please put your pants on. So I dashed over there with my portfolio, and the business agent for the union, his name was Zeal Fairbanks, as I remember, said, well, I can see why Lynn Sparhawk at Fox is so impressed with your work. He said, okay, it's all set up. You're going to go to Warner Brothers. And he started explaining where Warner's were, and he says, let me get him on the phone. So they talked to the person at the time who was in charge, was Art Lowe for Stanley Fleischer. And Art started telling me where, when I got to the lot at Warner Brothers, where to park. He says, it's a little difficult parking here. So he was trying to give me some tips on where to find a parking spot. And I thanked him. I didn't have the heart to tell him I didn't even have a car. So I had been going around with buses. And in this case, there was a phone booth right outside the union office on Sunset Boulevard. And so I got on phone, and I called a taxi cab. And I decided to spend some money and take a taxi cab out to Burbank, and where Warner's was. So they dropped me off at gate 2, ran through the gate, and ran up to the art department. The first thing Art asked me, did you have any trouble parking? I said, no, no trouble whatsoever. And so he introduced me to another art director, who was Leroy Dean. And Leroy they told me how much I was going to be making, and I got to tell you, I could, at that time, a junior illustrator made all of $237 a month, and a senior illustrator was $187. And as a junior illustrator, you know, I was expecting maybe something like $35-$40, and all of a sudden, it's like, this is all the money in the world to me. And I'm thinking, and he said, would that be enough? Would that be okay? And I said, well, yes. And then he asked me, he said, he said, are you married? And I'm thinking, why is he asking me that? And I said, well, no. He said, well, we have some location work. You might have to go to Acapulco, Mexico for a couple of weeks. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm going, and he said, by the way, did they tell you what the name of the film was or what film you'd be working? I said, no. And he said, well, it's a Frank Sinatra movie called Marriage, at that time, I think it was called Divorced American Style. But he said, Dean Martin's in it and Deborah Carr, and it looks like we're going to get Ann Margaret. And I'm thinking, I'm going to be in Acapulco with Ann Margaret, and I'm making this money, right? And, as it turned out, she wasn't in it. I later worked with her on another film, but, and they did, I went to Acapulco, but not on that, but on a later film, they decided to build a Mexican street on the back lot. But at the time, I'm thinking, all I could think of, I'm going to be in Acapulco with Ann Margaret and, you know, wow. And so, I said, you know, basically I told him I didn't believe all this was happening to me, and Lee Worry sort of laughed, and he said, what happens sometimes, Joe? He says, come on. He says, I'll take you out and I'll show you around the studio. So he walked out of the art department, which is on the side of a soundstage, and as soon as we walk out, we run into George Burns. He introduces me to George Burns, and he told me that I was just starting out on the film, this Frank Sinatra movie. And George says, well, why don't you bring him over to the set? We're doing the TV show, and show him a little bit of filming. And so we were, so that'd be fine. He said, let's go. At George Burns' invitation, we went over to the set, and he introduced me to Connie Stevens. He was, Gracie Allen had died a while back, and he was now doing a TV series with Connie Stevens. So they introduced me to Connie Stevens, and I'm there as George Burns' guest watching some filming being done, and it's like I couldn't believe any of this, you know. And I was thinking, today Connie Stevens, tomorrow Ann Margaret, you know. And so the funny thing is, the first assignment, now here I am, I can draw lions, elephants, gorillas, people, you know, architecture, and I drew the walls of Fort Zinderhof and Foreign Legion walls, so I knew architecture. And the first project I got working for Frank Sinatra's company on this film, which was Marriage on the Rocks, was Frank had just bought a new Jet Ranger helicopter, and his favorite color scheme was orange. So he wanted orange designs on his Jet Ranger helicopter. And I'm thinking to myself, I could do all this and that. I never thought about what kind of designs I could put on a helicopter that are orange that Frank Sinatra's like. And I'm thinking my whole career is going to go, I blew my first assignment, you know. But fortunately, Frank's pilot came in. Leroy brought Frank's pilot in and introduced me to him. And he says, well, in the past, I think Frank liked this and liked that. So he told me the different parts of the helicopter that he thought Frank would like to see in orange. So basically, there were some white areas with orange designs on it, trimmed in black. And Frank liked that. And, of course, thanks to the pilot who kind of had an inkling, Frank loved what I did. So I was in with Frank Sinatra. And so I went on from there, and I stayed at Warner's. And the other interesting thing when you're talking about filming and doing the storyboards, Frank had a scar on the left side, a mastoid scar on the back of his neck below his ear. And so I guess he didn't want to bother taking care of a plastic surgeon, but it would kind of, even with makeup on, kind of show up. So we had to be very careful, and we couldn't show Frank entering a set showing a close-up profile of the left side of his head. We could show him three-quarter, entering that way, or we could show the right side or the front, the back, but we really couldn't feature camera angle that would show that portion of the neck to see that scar. And so I had to, which necessitated the storyboards that I was doing and also the sets that Leroy Dean, the art director, production designer, was designing for Frank to enter. So they would design it. If Frank is going to enter a room, then he didn't have to enter in a way that you would see this neck, the scar on the left side of his neck, which was kind of interesting. So all his sets had to be carefully designed like that. Now, I can't go back to his early days when he started out at RKO and later MGM as to what they did. But later on, after he was calling his own shots and had his own production company, which was Artanis, which, interesting, was Sinatra spelled backwards. he was calling the shots, and we had to be very careful like that, which we were. And also in the sets, we always had to have certain notes of orange or burnt orange. The irony of that is years later when I worked for Irwin Allen, Irwin Allen's favorite color was orange too. So the one thing that he and Frank had in common was they both like little notes of orange in the set. So
that's why Irwin Allen did Towering Inferno. A lot of orange flames in that.
Flames, exactly right. Yeah. So, anyhow, I after working on Marriage on the Rocks with Frank, they assigned me to brainstorm with Dana Andrews and Jeffrey Hunter and Ann Francis, and William Conrad was directing. And after that, I worked on Big Hand for a Little Lady with Henry Fonda and Joanne Woodward. And all of a sudden, I felt like it wasn't total Western, but all of a sudden, I am working on a Western. I got a chance to do some of that Victorian stuff in the saloon and the little TNG and whatever. So, I mean, I was, what can I say? I was just drawing away, having a... not really believing I'm getting paid for all this. And then after that, they assigned me to work on Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and which I did with Richard Taylor and Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. Sorry about that. And then after that, I went to, it was one of those things where Jack Warner was like, production was going, wanted to slow down, so he would have some of these slow down areas where he had enough stuff in a can, he could go for a while, we'll go on a little lighter. So I went to Fox, I caught up Lynn Sparrow, we got something over here, I started working on the Blue Max and all the aerial scenes, and working on the action scenes, and for a producer by the name of Bob Jacks, who we became good friends and years later continued to do stuff for him on the side and some other projects. And then after that, I worked for Hitchcock for the next 8 months. And interesting enough, working for Hitchcock was because I had, really been in town for not all that long, a year and a half, and somehow was trying to do things, get credit and various things. And of course, when they found out that I put down who you're working for and I put Alfred Hitchcock down, it was like the magic word all of a sudden. Well, he's got to be good if he's credible. So I don't think Hitchcock realizes all the credit he was able to give me just by his name. But
well, Blue Max must have been a great picture for you because it was historical. For people who don't know what it is, it's film about a German flying ace in World War One, nice, with George Peppard, James Mason's in it. Pretty right. Good picture. Not a great picture. Pretty good picture.
Yeah, and
In terms of your interest in history and everything converging for you, that must have been maybe the first film that was like all your interest at once.
Right? Well, that's true. And the interesting thing is what they signed me to was the action scenes, the various flying scenes, and they had so many SC-5, the planes that they were using in the film, and we had to do different things, double print, make them look like a little bit more, certain formations, laying all the stuff out. Because, again, when you start putting these pilots up in the air and shooting these planes and getting a reality, you really got to know what you're doing, not just come back with tons of footage hoping that they can cut something together. And it was very, very specific. And, of course, they needed to know where they drop in on a process stage where they're going to put George Peppard or somebody else in the airplane to do these scenes. So I was basically doing all the storyboarding and, you know, some of the battle scenes. And they were filming a lot of this, I remember, in Ireland. And so we're laying out all this stuff in Hollywood, which, in this case, Bob Jacks was going to take over to Ireland because the director at that time was John Gillerman, who I would work with on several films after that, including Towering Inferno. So it was, you know, what can I say? It was an interesting experience because all of a sudden I'm getting a chance to work on an historic movie. And again, in this case, you know, kind of recreate a mood and atmosphere. And I guess the audiences don't realize, but particularly when you're doing airplanes in the sky, you got to create movement. You got to have some cloud formations behind you, because no matter what you do with that airplane, if it's just blue sky, it's just going to look like blue sky, and there's not going to be much movement. So you got to do things with the planes that they're going as fast as you want them to be, and it's the relationship with clouds. Not only does it give good composition, but it shows the movement. And
you know, that was the thing in Wings when they couldn't get any clouds, and Wellman kept the whole company just sitting there for a month, over a month in San Antonio, because
of the clouds. Yeah. And they suddenly realized years before, just having no clouds in there would just be deadly. So why even film without the clouds? And
you get no perspective without
exactly. You don't know really. And in some cases, when you're mixing it up in a dogfight and you got explosions and things going on, yes, you can do some things with that. But till you get to that point, it looks like nothing's happening. So you really have to have a and it can't be an all white. I mean, it can't be all clouds that the screen is white. And it can't be all blue, so it's got to be somewhere. There's got to be some cumulus clouds or other clouds, either strafing some part of it that the plane is going to come in and out of or whatever it's going to do. And so we had to reflect that in the storyboards at the same time, too. And, you know, what can I say? Once that was, it was rather interesting too, because working with Bob Jacks, it was, they had footage, World War I footage that some of these documentaries had put together. And so prior to doing that, we were studying the footage. And so I was going into the Daryl Zanuck screening room in the producer's building, and here I am going from the art department, and I'm sitting in the XYZ room of the, 20th Century Fox Studios in these luxurious leather couches watching the footage, and, you know, Bob is saying, let's do this or let's do that, or saying to the projector, because not like today with DVDs or Blu-rays where you can stop frame and, you know, just go back or forward or zoom in. At that time with the projector, they literally had to stop the projector, rewind, and then play it again, which we were doing before we were trying to piece all this together on the big screen. And because even in that, it was almost like we had to do it on a big screen, because we couldn't even do it on the Moviola, because you got a small screen. They wanted to see the perspective of the sky, the detail. I mean, that was the whole purpose, to see how much we could. We were designing movies for the big screen in CinemaScope. We weren't designing it for a little Moviola or a small TV screen. And and this was going to be one of Fox's big epics at the time. And they were buoyed by, of course, the success of The Longest Day, which was World War II. And here was a chance to do something in color and get a gritty feel to World War I. And And I think those scenes that we worked on, I look at it today and I'm saying, gee, in my own little way, I had a hand in some of this.
Yeah, I just watched that movie not too long ago. It's a pretty good movie. Of course, it's got Ursula Andress in it.
Yes. That was exactly right. That was one of the pluses, although she was over in Europe, and I didn't get to meet her at that time.
I was thinking earlier when you mentioned that you worked on a Henry Fonda movie, that must have been special, too, because, I mean, your love of John Ford films, and especially Ford Apache, and these films that Fonda was in. Were you ever able, when you worked with stars and you worked with, geez, everybody, do you ever talk to them about their careers, or was it because you were in a professional basis, there wasn't really any place to do that?
The answer is yes or no. And in some cases, after a while, especially when you get to know some of the stars, sometimes there were some burning questions I had to ask people. Like I had to ask John Wayne, who played Geronimo in Fort Apache, and he told me, "Sign on many mules." So I was like, when you meet John Wayne, what do you say to him? Well, I wanted to know who played Geronimo in Fort Apache. And but there were other times, like when I met Sidney Poitier, and it was one of those things, he was directing Ghost Dad, and it was even before they started filming or even pre-production, before anything happened, since Bill Cosby was supposed to be a ghost going in and out, they needed a budget to put together with the special effects. And the only way they could do it is to show a series of storyboards to the effects companies to get estimates. So in this case, Sidney and I basically were worked together, just the two of us sat down for like 2 to 3 weeks working out these effect shots. And so the answer is yes. In that kind of environment, working with Sidney, who is just a wonderful person, I got to ask him, because one of my favorite films that he did was Something of Value years ago, and it still remains one of my favorite movies. And I got to ask him and discuss Something of Value with him. Now, I had already met Sidney before because I worked on In the Heat of the Night. But it was one of those things where you meet him, he's a star, you didn't get a chance to talk. But years later, when we sat down and I was having a one-on-one with Sidney, I brought up a couple of things, and he, of course, went into detail, and he said, what a wonderful film that was. And there was times, and he really made you feel special, because there was times, like, we're sitting there at work, he says, and we're in his offices, and basically in Beverly Hills, and he said, Joe, he says, I think it's time for lunch. How about such and such a restaurant? Of course, I didn't know the restaurants yet. So we went down there and going to the restaurant, and Gene Wilder comes in, and he introduces me to Gene Wilder and says, Joe and I are working together laying out the storyboard. So, I mean, he basically put me on a one-on-one with Gene Wilder. And also, like, a situation like with Irwin Allen, when I was doing some stuff for him, and I laid out a conceptual sketch and showing it to him. And, of course, Irwin's gone over the sketch. And Robert Wagner, was coming in because he had a meeting with him. And so, and I didn't realize, I'm in there, Irwin's gone over the illustration I did for him, and suddenly the secretary beamed in and said that, Mr. Wagner's here, Mr. Allen. He says, oh, send him in. And so in comes Robert Wagner, and Irwin's gone over to sketch with me, and he looks up, he says, oh, he says, Bob, he says, meet Joe Musso, the illustrator, working on this. Look at the sketch he did on this scene. And Bob's looking at this and that. Well, from that moment on, wherever Bob Wagner saw me, he had the biggest hello for me. How you doing, Joe? And, it was just one of those things where, in some cases, and particularly the answer is like with Henry Fonda, yes, I got to know him well enough that I could sit there and have a conversation with him and talk to him about Fort Apache too, which kind of had a big influence on me as a six-year-old kid. And so, and actually gave me a love for the Apache Indians, which I still have today. I think if I had a chance of doing, I'm proud of my Italian heritage, but I think if I could be one part of something else, I'd probably be, want to be part Irish, part Scots, and part Apache Indian just because of that. And, the answer, in some cases, no, you just work with them on a professional basis. But on other times, I had a chance to really sit down with the actors and, ask them a couple of things that it might have been burning in my mind, and through the years, still get to know them on a basis of, well, obviously I'm not their long lost friend, but at least on a professional basis, we say hello or, how are you, and make some small talk here and there. And although I got to say the field is getting rather limited now because all of the stars that I grew up with are unfortunately either not around anymore or just not working or sort of getting to the point where they're not available. But
we're out of time, but we've got so much more to talk about, so we're definitely going to have you back for at least four more episodes in the near future.
Well, thank you.
Because we've got to talk about Irwin Allen. We've got to talk about John Wayne. We've got to talk about the Alamo. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about.
Okay.
And, of course, we've got many more Beaujet stories to tell.
Okay, so, I'll be looking forward to it.
Thanks very much. This has been a great pleasure, Joe.
Thank you, Frank.
Thanks.
Well, I told you we were only going to scratch the surface, and we sure did. It was still a really fun conversation, and we have lots, lots, lots more to talk with Joe about. So he'll be back one of these days. Don't you worry about that. For no other reason than I want another excuse to go over to his house. It's really something. I want to thank everybody who had a hand in getting this podcast. Well, I keep wanting to say on the air. I'm really not quite sure what to call it, but in the ether, wherever it is. I thank Gary Rand and Rob Clearfield for our wonderful theme music. Today, I think I want to do the rather Copeland-esque, touching outro music. I like this a lot. It sometimes seems a little sad, and there's nothing sad about this episode tonight, but I don't know. It's just sort of a contemplative piece. I like it. So thanks to Rob and Gary. Thanks also to James Hutchins, who designed my website, thecommentarytrack.com. I hope you will go there often. I hope you will look for the movies and books associated with all of my guests. If you look at each of their podcast pages, click on View Full Details, you'll see Amazon links to all sorts of stuff that they've had a hand in. And I'm not even going to load in half the stuff that Joe has worked on because I just don't have the bandwidth to do it because, man, is he prolific. But a lot of things that we've talked about tonight, there will be Amazon links. If you link through Amazon and buy something on Amazon through my site, then I'll get a little tiny kickback. But little tiny kickbacks add up. Mighty oaks from tiny acorns grow, as Stan and Ollie have assured us. So I urge you to do that. I also urge you to go to iTunes, go to the commentary track page, and give the podcast a rave review and a five-star rating. This is not to just stroke my fragile ego, although it does do that, and it is very fragile. But it also helps to attract other people to the site. The better known it is, the more people will listen. Then the more people will buy through Amazon and buy my own books. And pretty soon I'll be rich. Rich, I tells you. So please do that. So one of these days this will come close to being a break-even proposition instead of the damn busted flood of outlay that it currently is. So go to the website, thecommentarytrack.com, go to iTunes, and then when you've done all that stuff, come back next week. And next week is a big one. I think if you're at all interested in film, I don't need to say anything more than next week's guest is Kevin Brownlow. So join me next time, and don't worry, we'll fix it in post.